Greetings, this is Tyler McFeeters with your News Gazette, dated Friday, December 19th, 2025. We'll begin today's reading on the front page with an article, CU Schools Foundation, Teaching Skills. Grant funding makes for a sweeter time in Franklin Students Baking Club. Story by Rob LaCates. Out of Champaign. A Franklin STEAM Academy teacher's garage sale-bought KitchenAid mixer can finally return home thanks to a $300 grant from the CU Schools Foundation. Jennifer Meline, advisor for the Pastry People Baking Club, wrote a grant request for stand and handheld mixers, which she said would help students develop transferable skills. Thanks to the grant, one of each kind of mixer was purchased for the club around Thanksgiving. Students now tend to crowd around the refurbished, shiny, silver stand mixer, wanting to take a turn to add ingredients when baking. Getting the grant for these mixers has provided ease of planning and carting materials back and forth, she said. The students all love an opportunity to use the stand and hand mixer whenever one arises. Meline's personal mixer was bought by her grandmother around 10 years ago, who instilled a love for baking ever since she was in school. I always joke with the kids that I walked past my grandma's house on the way home from school every day, and it never failed if we stopped at her house. She either had just gotten done making cookies, or she was going to make cookies, and she asked if we wanted to help, Meline said. Now she wanted to pass along the joy of baking to students. Meline, who is in her fifth year at the middle school, introduced the extracurricular idea at the start of her second year, when club forms became available for new faculty. The Pastry People Club, meeting within the Life Skills classroom, teaches students how to operate microwaves and ovens, knead dough, and more. With some enthusiastic support from her principal, David Mast, Meline sent out an interest form to see how many students would bite. She expected no more than 24 kids, and that was being generous, but opened the electronic sign-up sheet and was surprised. I put out a Google form thinking maybe I'll have 5, 10, maybe 20 kids. And then I had to shut the answers off when I hit 90, she said. The after-school program consistently maintains a high number of members and draws attention from every corner of the building. In order to handle all the students, Meline equally separates the students into four groups, with each one meeting once a month. Adela Hernandez, a seventh grader, expressed how she enjoyed working with friends and being able to interact with people she didn't know beforehand. Plus, she learned how versatile baking is. They teach us a lot of things about replacements that we can do for baking if you have allergies or restrictions, Hernandez said. I think that's really cool, because I learned a lot of things about how baking works that I didn't know before. Melissa Rebhe, another seventh grader, said she loves learning about the technical side of baking. We get to work with our friends, and we learn new strategies to make stuff when we run out of ingredients. It's kind of helpful, she said. If you don't have ingredients, instead of just quitting, you come up with new strategies. Some of the students' favorite recipes have included strawberry cheesecake cookies and Oreo cupcakes. The best part of this club was sampling and sharing the treats, Hernandez said. One thing I really like about this club is once we're done baking, there's usually enough for everyone to have at least 2 treats, Hernandez said. Then the leftovers we give to other teachers and janitors in the building, which is really fun. Even if she had a long day, Meline doesn't lose her excitement for the club. But when I get there with the kids and they're all so happy and having such a great time, and even if our recipe flops for the night, they're still thrilled, she said. Nobody's ever angry or grumpy. They're just happy to be there and to be trying something new. Next story is, Leal kindergarten teachers use grant funds to get jump on a play-driven curriculum. Story by Rob LaCates. Out of Urbana. 2 Leal Elementary School kindergarten teachers are changing the learning landscape. The kids don't see it as that, though. For them, it's just normal playtime. The vision came to life last summer after teachers Jamie Jones and Amanda Nelson participated in a professional development workshop themed around purposeful play, which inspired their Play with Purpose grant project. They applied for their first grant through the CU Schools Foundation and were approved. The 2 initially requested $1,000, but the foundation granted them only $500. With that money, they purchased toys they'd incorporate into lessons, where kids could take the information from each lesson and apply it, all while playing. As kindergarten teachers, we know developmentally that our students need the play, but curriculum pieces, ours included, do not have those things in them natively, Jones said. However, now in the state of Illinois, coming in the 2026-2027 school years, play-based kindergarten is the law. Let's start now, because we've been talking about it, she said. The two teachers implemented this method in several lessons in the past. For instance, last school year, the teachers threw a tea party, where the kindergartners dressed up in their fanciest attire and learned about kings, queens, and royalty. Another time, the students learned about cooking during a Native American unit using meals from those cultures. One of the children's favorite days was when construction workers visited the classroom, and students drilled and hammered fasteners into a wooden board, which they loved. When the class learned about farms and animals, Jones said, the teachers each made a stand in their classrooms where items could be sold. She stocked the stand with plastic food and a cash register. Soon after, the students plugged in their imaginations and took off. The kids used the scene as a grocery store, a restaurant, a veterinarian's office, and even a place where witches brewed potions. The lessons the 5- and 6-year-olds learned encouraged collaboration, improved social-emotional growth, and utilized creativity, the teachers said. Through hands-on activities, the teachers noticed the spark in students' eyes when they enacted what they had learned. We know how important play is, so this was a good jumping point for us to really see where we can take the kids, Nelson said. The newly purchased toys, including camping supplies, kitchenware, puppets, wooden embroidery panels, and gardening and meteorology tools. All playthings were bought with the intention of building students' motor skills and life skills to help students who aren't learning them at home. The kids, though, don't realize the impact these lessons teach. For them, that's not a life skill. That's not a learning thing. That's a play thing, Jones said. The duo said that sticking an electronic device in front of a child may be easy, but allowing children to play will help them in the long run. Finding that time to plug in purpose play, where they're not looking at a device, it is legitimate, hands-on, using your brain play. Jones said, that can get loud, and that's hard at home and at school. As a parent, Jones said she wanted quiet time at home, but that isn't what is best for her children, because they need to play. This is us giving our students that chance to be kids, because you're only going to be 5 and 6 once, and this time is fleeting, and the things that we can introduce and make sure that they have are huge, Jones said. You never know what things like this can inspire later. The next front page story is Parkland College, grad day problem solved via division. Two ceremonies to be held on same day to fix capacity issue. Story by Luke Taylor, out of Champaign. For the first time, Parkland College will host not one but two commencement ceremonies this spring, celebrating graduates from the health professions programs at a separate time from the rest of the school. Both ceremonies will have the same structure and use the same space, which is the reason the college made the split. Parkland's Vice President for Student Services, Michael Traim, said the graduation participation has risen so much that the Krannert Center's Great Hall would no longer have the capacity the college needs. We looked at the problem of increasing participation over the last couple years, with only one ceremony making us really shrink the number of guests that each graduate could bring, Traim said. That's a little oppositional to what our mission is. We like to celebrate the accomplishments of our students and the impacts they have on our friends and family and community. The two ceremonies will be held on the same day, just a few hours apart, so no students should expect a major change in their schedule to graduate. Traim said that while different colleges and universities split their commencement ceremonies up various ways, Parkland decided to separate out health profession students partly because of the number graduating and partly with the goal of highlighting their impact on the community. We looked at how we can slice and dice our graduation participation in a way that was meaningful and made sense and provided some of the numbers that we were looking for on that front, Traim said. You know, it's hard to go to the doctor or the clinic in town here and not be served by some person that Parkland has trained in the health professions. be it a nurse, be it a dental hygienist, be it a respiratory therapist or x-ray technician. They serve such a large piece, and we didn't have a real good way of showcasing that publicly. Across all the professions involved, Trame said the expectation is that there will be well over 200 health profession students graduating that day. Splitting the groups this way also made time for a pinning ceremony that has been traditional to health profession graduation ceremonies for some time. That commencement ceremony will be held at 2 p.m. May 14th, while the rest of the graduates will be recognized in a ceremony at 7 p.m. on the same day. Trame said the additional time allows for more elements recognizing achievements in the broader graduation ceremony as well. Speakers can be contextualized too, with one address more aimed at health professions and another at the general audience, though Trame said the identities of the speakers will be kept under wraps for a time. While other venues around town could theoretically host a combined ceremony for all graduates with plenty of space for guests, Trame said the scale jumps up pretty rapidly from the Cranard Center. The Great Hall has been the venue of choice for Parkland due to the ideal size as well as the style of the place itself. We're very fortunate to have a partner in the University of Illinois who allows us to rent that space from them for our commencements, and their team does a great job in hosting us for those, Trame said. It just provides a really elegant and professional venue that we don't have here at that size on our campus, and that really doesn't exist in the community anywhere else in that, again, kind of atmosphere and size. And the next front page story is The Neighbors at the Ice House, Ownership and Theme Changes on Tap for Bar. Story by Jana Wiersema, out of Champaign. A neighborhood bar is expected to reopen in early 2026 with new owners and a new theme. Heather Fowler said that a small local ownership group, including herself and James McNeely, purchased The Neighbors at the Ice House, about 2 weeks ago, and hopes to reopen the bar in mid to late February as The Boxcar on Prospect. When the opportunity came up, we saw it as a chance to really honor the history of Champaign and the building's past, Fowler said. The bar is currently closed as its new owners take care of transition paperwork and add a change of decor inspired by vintage train cars and the location's proximity to the railroad. We're looking at with bringing that vintage train car inspiration to the inside. We're adding a subtle twist, and it's going to be mostly featured as a tiki bar, she said. And then we are going to make sure that it is still grounded as a neighborhood bar as well, with all the local favorites still available. In addition to The Neighbors at the Ice House, the Prospect Avenue property has been home to a number of businesses over the years, including the Major Brothers Grocery, the Alonzo H. Ferris Restaurant, the Charles H. Lyons Beer Tavern, the William J. Armstrong Food Store, Armstrong's Tavern, Jack Strunk's Tavern, Unk and George's Tavern, Van's Pit Stop, and Fallon's Ice House. Owner Mary Petrie closed The Neighbors at the Ice House in 2024 and put it on the market, only to reopen the bar in November of that year. However, she later put the bar up for sale again following the death of manager Diane Bennett, who also had equity in the business. We saw it as a great chance to keep a piece of history in the community and just bring new life into it, Fowler said. So we won't be doing a lot of major changes aside from the rebrand. Next story is in the National and World News section. U.S. Government, Congress heading home, avoiding healthcare votes. Story by Dave Goldiner of New York Daily News, TNS. The Republican Congress headed home for the holidays Thursday without doing anything about health insurance costs set to skyrocket for more than 20 million Americans when Affordable Care Act tax credits expire on January 1st. Despite an 11th-hour squabble over dueling proposals, and with President Donald Trump mostly silent, GOP House Speaker Mike Johnson scrapped Friday votes and sent the House home a day early. Trump expressed no interest in getting involved in the debate over the Obamacare credits. I don't know why we have to extend, he said Thursday at an unrelated press event. Johnson didn't bring up a Democratic bill that would extend the subsidies for 3 years
even after a handful of Republican moderates crossed the aisle to demand a vote on it. The House will consider the bill only in January, after millions of Americans get hit with sticker shock or are unable to pay for insurance at all. Even if the tax credit extension bill passes in the House, the Republican Senate Majority Leader John Thune says the upper chamber is unlikely to even consider it, let alone pass it with the 60 votes needed. The Senate also prepared to head home without taking up the Republican House health bill that passed on a party-line vote late Wednesday. That measure includes several conservative health care goals designed to give Republican lawmakers talking points to defend their stance, to give voters who give Trump's GOP poor marks on both health care and rising costs. Trump barely mentioned health care in his primetime speech late Wednesday. He pointed the finger at Democrats for higher health insurance premiums coming in 2026, even though it's his own party leaders who allowed the tax credits to expire. You see that now in the steep increase in premiums being demanded by the Democrats, Trump said. It's their fault. Democratic congressional leaders Representative Hakeem Jeffries and Senator Chuck Schumer say Republicans have chosen not to deal with the looming health crisis for months, even though they could have done so in Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill, which included steep cuts to Medicaid for lower-income people. The American people deserve a vote on the Affordable Care Act tax credit legislation and deserve that vote today, Jeffries said on the steps of the Capitol. The next story in national and world news, John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. Trump-picked board votes to rename venue in his honor. Their authority to make such a decision is far from certain. Story by Jessica Gelt of Los Angeles Times, TNS. White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt said on Thursday that the board of the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts voted to change the name of the world-famous complex to the Trump Kennedy Center. I have just been informed that the highly respected board of the Kennedy Center, some of the most successful people from all parts of the world, have just voted unanimously to rename the Kennedy Center to the Trump Kennedy Center, because of the unbelievable work President Trump has done over the last year in saving the building, Leavitt posted on X. Roma Devravi, Vice President of Public Relations for the Center, confirmed the news of the name change. The Kennedy Center Board of Trustees voted unanimously today to name the institution the Donald J. Trump and the John F. Kennedy Memorial Center for the Performing Arts, Devravi said in a statement. The unanimous vote recognizes that the current chairman saved the institution from financial ruin and physical destruction. The new Trump Kennedy Center reflects the unequivocal bipartisan support for America's cultural center for generations to come. According to a post on X by Representative Joyce Beatty, Democrat of Ohio, an ex officio member of the board, the vote was not unanimous. I was muted on the call and not allowed to speak or voice my opposition to this move. Also, for the record, this was not on the agenda. This was not consensus. This is censorship, Beatty wrote. In a video accompanying her post, Beatty said, "Clearly the Congress has a say in this. It's important for us to know that this is another attempt to evade the law and not let the people have their say." Kennedy Center President Ambassador Richard Grinnell, however, tweeted that ex officio members historically don't get a vote. The news rattled the arts world but was not unexpected. Ever since Trump fired the existing board in early February and installed himself as chairman, rumors have circulated that a name change might be imminent, and the president has repeatedly hinted at it. The legality of changing the name of the center through a simple board vote remains unclear. The Kennedy Center was established as a living memorial by federal statute, making congressional approval a requirement for an official name change. Congratulations to President Donald J. Trump, and likewise congratulations to President Kennedy, because this will be a truly great team long into the future. The building will no doubt attain new levels of success and grandeur, Leavitt continued in her post. The proposed name change is part of a series of sweeping changes that Trump and his newly appointed board, including board president Richard Grinnell, have enacted since they took over management of the center. When the president first announced the changes, he said he was eliminating all those who do not share our vision for a golden age in arts and culture. A number of Trump's closest allies were appointed to the board, including Chief of Staff Susie Wiles, Attorney General Pam Bondi, Second Lady Usha Vance, and conservative TV host Laura Ingraham. Major stars soon pulled out of leadership positions at the center, including TV producer Shonda Rhimes, musician Ben Folds, and opera star Renee Fleming, and a variety of high-profile touring shows such as Hamilton canceled upcoming engagements. The Kennedy Center has long been an artistic center historically devoid of a political point of view, with programming agnostic to the policy shifts of the times. At its heart, Hamilton celebrates American diversity. The recent shift in the Kennedy Center's ideology and board leadership has made it untenable for a production like Hamilton to celebrate and be celebrated there today, Hamilton creator Lin-Manuel Miranda said in a statement to the Times in March. In October, the Washington Post reported that ticket sales had plummeted for the Kennedy Center's three largest performance venues. With his takeover of the Kennedy Center, Trump has taken a special interest in shaping the artistic narrative of the venue. He has made it clear that he loves big Broadway shows like Les Miserables, and he handpicked a new crop of performers for the recent Kennedy Center honors, including Sylvester Stallone, George Strait, and the rock band Kiss. In the next story in the National and World News, Justice Department, Illinois joins list of states sued for voter info. Out of Madison, Wisconsin, and the AP. The U.S. Justice Department sued three states and the District of Columbia on Thursday for not turning over requested voter information to the Trump administration. The latest lawsuits were filed against Wisconsin, Illinois, Georgia, and the District of Columbia. The Justice Department has now filed 22 lawsuits seeking voter information as part of its effort to collect detailed voting data and other election information across the country. We shared our nation-leading list maintenance practices and public voter roll data with the DOJ December 8th at their request, and we look forward to working together to eliminate the federal barriers that prevent even cleaner voter rolls, Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger said in a statement. Hardworking Georgians can rest easy knowing this data is shared strictly in accordance with state law that protect voters' privacy. The latest round comes 1 week after the bipartisan Wisconsin Elections Commission voted against the Justice Department's request for the data. Both Republican and Democratic commissioners voiced concerns about the request last week, saying it would be illegal under Wisconsin law to provide the voter roll information that includes the full names, dates of birth, residential addresses, and driver's license numbers of voters. Spokespeople for the Wisconsin Elections Commission and the State Department of Justice, which would defend the commission, did not immediately return messages. The Illinois State Board of Elections declined to comment. An AP tally found that the Justice Department has asked at least 26 states for voter registration rolls in recent months. The next story is immigration in Chicago. Commission listens to testimony about excessive force by ICE agents. Story by Maggie Doherty out of Chicago. A newly formed commission heard sobering testimony about federal agents' excessive use of force just days after Border Patrol Chief Gregory Bovino was spotted back in the city. The Illinois Accountability Commission held its first public meeting Thursday in the city's Little Village neighborhood to compile an official public record of misconduct by federal agents during the Trump administration's Operation Midway Blitz immigration enforcement campaign this fall. The images are shocking and impossible to look away from, but most importantly, it's going to be impossible to forget, said Ruben Castillo, commission chair and former chief judge for the Northern District of Illinois. This cannot be the new normal. The mandate for the commission set by Governor J.B. Pritzker in an October executive order includes documenting abuses by federal agents and issuing recommendations for policy and legal actions. Castillo said commission staff had already been busy reviewing evidence and vowed they would investigate every single allegation of abuse by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement and other federal agents. Though it does not have the legal power to compel testimony or prosecute cases itself, the commission may recommend prosecution of agents accused of misconduct. In January, the commission will open a portal where the public can submit information for review. The commission is required to issue a public status update by the end of January and a final report by the end of April. During Tuesday's 3-hour hearing, the commission listened to testimony from emergency medical physician and University of California Berkeley lecturer Rohini Har, who reviewed 30 hours of public footage of federal agents' use of chemical weapons, such as tear gas and pepper balls, against protesters, journalists, and bystanders in the Chicago area. Chemical weapons are only supposed to be used when there is a direct threat to public safety and no viable alternatives, Har testified. When they are deployed, there are certain conditions and precautions that must be present to justify their use. For example, precautions should be taken to ensure that children, elderly, or other vulnerable populations are protected. Warnings must be issued before use, and weapons should not be fired directly at people, especially toward necks and faces, or in enclosed spaces like cars. Chemical irritants are inherently indiscriminate, Har said. Once you fire it, there is no saying where the wind blows or who it targets, so you cannot control an individual with this, and you can't target it. Bovino and others were the subjects of a slew of federal court hearings this fall, with Bovino at one point ordered to report to a federal judge daily until an appeals court issued a stay to that order. Bovino and immigration agents left the city in mid-November for Charlotte, North Carolina, and other locations, but recently were spotted back in Chicago. While chemical agents are classified as less lethal weapons, they can have serious health effects, Har testified. The canisters thrown can themselves cause blunt force trauma, while the chemicals they contain can cause myriad respiratory, skin, and eye injuries. In some cases, Har said, use of chemical weapons has left people dead or with severe injuries. In many cases, people have long-lasting psychological trauma symptoms. Upon review of the Chicago incidents, Har said she saw cases of indiscriminate use of chemical weapons against children and the elderly, used in enclosed spaces, weapons fired without warning, or attempts to address the situation with other tactics, such as communication. And we will take a short break now and return with the second half hour of your News Gazette, dated Friday, December 19th, 2025. Please stay tuned.